In sketch number 5 we have an illustration of ingenious barbarity worthy of the palmy days of the Inquisition, two pairs of handcuffs each, on the wrists and ankles, a rope running through the links of each and passing out of the cabinet at top and bottom, and a halter noose around the neck, drawn just tight enough to choke without quite strangling, made an applauding public feel secure against humbug. Bristol, Connecticut, richly deserves the credit for this apparatus, and the additional statement that it was applied for the space of nearly 2.5 hours. Here, finally, in sketch number 7, we have an effectual device to prevent the exercise of ventriloquial powers in imitation of spirit voices, which has been tried in so many places, not to mention Sing Sing and other penitentiary establishments, that I forbear to recount them, lest I might weary. And now let us drop this disagreeable part of our subject. It matters little to me how the skeptical may undertake to account for these Chittenden mysteries that concerns themselves alone. They may attribute them to electricity, but if so, they will have to encounter scientists like Varley, the electrician of the Atlantic cable, who, after testing them by every electrical apparatus, with 26 years' experience to guide him, declares that that subtle agent has nothing whatever to do with their production. Of the late Professor Hare, who made the same statement after 2 years of careful inquiry, of Eliotson, Paisker, Crookes, Bell, Collier, Gully, the French Academicians, and the London Dialectical Society. If they say it is animal magnetism, they must face an army of specialists who have exhausted every endeavor to explain away the phenomena as coming under this category. The knee pan, toe joint and knuckle worthies, as a class, die a natural death as soon as we get beyond the mere Rochester wrappings of 1847, and I feel confident that if Professors Huxley and Tyndall would spend a fortnight at Chittenden, they would see their protoplasms and such like scientific soothing syrups flying out of the window upon the entry of the first materialized ghost from William Eddy's closet. It is scarcely exaggeration to say that this family of mediums, if we may believe their story, is the most remarkable as to psychological endowments of which mention is made in the history of European races. Perhaps among the Chinese, and certain tribes of India, the Yogeswaras, for instance, and of Egypt, parallel cases may be found, but such have not met my eye in the course of a somewhat extensive reading in this branch of literature. The Eds represent about every phase of mediumship and seership: wrappings, the disturbance of material objects from a state of rest, painting in oil and water colors under influence, prophecy, the speaking of strange tongues, the healing gift, the discernment of spirits, levitation, or the floating of the body in free air, the phenomena of instrument playing and the show of hands, the writing of messages on paper up and in midair, by pencils held by detached hands, psychometry, or the reading of character and view of distant persons upon touching scaled letters, clairvoyance, clairaudience, or the hearing of spirit voices, and, lastly, and most miraculous of all, the production of materialized phantom forms, that become visible, tangible, and often audible by all persons present. Much account has been made of the story told by Lord Dunraven and Lord Adair, and, I may mention, confirmed to me personally by the latter gentleman, of Mr. Holmes having been floated out of one third-story window at Ashley House and into another. But what will be thought of Horatio Eddy having been carried, one summer night, when he was but 6 years old, a distance of 3 miles to a mountain top, and left to find his way home next day as best he could of his youngest brother Webster, when a grown man, being carried out of the window and over the top of a house from the presence of 3 witnesses, from 2 of whom I have the story, and landed in a ditch a quarter of a mile off, of William being carried to a distant wood and kept there unconscious for 3 days, and then carried back again, of Horatio being levitated 26 evenings in succession, in Buffalo, in the Lyceum Hall, when fast bound in a chair, and hung by the back of the chair to a chandelier hook in the ceiling, and then safely lowered again to his former place on the floor? Of Mary Eddy being raised to the ceiling of Hope Chapel, in New York City, where she wrote her name? Of her little boy, Warren, 5 years old, who is floated in dark circles, screaming to be let down all the while, of a little son of Stephen Baird, of Chittenden, a neighbor of theirs, who has been handled in the same way. Mr. Home is not the only one besides the Eds who has been thus transported through midair, for, since 1347, authenticated reports will be found in the books of a like thing happening to Edward Irving, Margaret Rule, St. Philip of Neri, Street Catherine of Columbina, Loyola, Savonarola, Jenny Lord, Madame Hauff, and many others whose names I do not at present recall, and in the absence of a library cannot transcribe. Does anyone care to ask me what I think? I answer, nothing. I watch and wait and report, holding myself open to conviction in the spirit which the great Arago describes in an old article on mesmerism, the man who, outside of pure mathematics, pronounces the word impossible, is wanting in prudence. I make no apology for having now devoted two preliminary chapters to personal details respecting the Eddy family history, for the intelligent reader, before he could give credence to the miraculous events that I shall describe as occurring in their presence, would of necessity ask what sort of people they are, whether they were of suspicious antecedents, whether they had amassed a fortune by their exhibitions, whether they are making money by them now, or what motive impels them to continue in their present public relation. I stated above that they travel for the profit of others, by which I meant to say that when William, Horatio, and Mary were young children, their father, having failed to cowhide their demons out of them, hired them out to a showman for 4 years, they receiving nothing but their bare expenses, and that at the expiration of that time they were hired by various other speculators, and during the ensuing 11 years received an average of under $10 a month apiece. I mean, furthermore, to say that their house and farm would not sell for $3,500 all told, that they do all their housework themselves, that half their visitors are poor and sponge on them for board, and, the other half paying $8 per week, the family have saved enough to put some necessary repairs on the house, and finally that they unite in saying that the greatest good fortune that could befall them would be to have their mediumship cease, so that they might work like other farmers and enjoy life like them. They are the galley slaves of the invisible powers back of the manifestations, who not only obsess them at their caprice by day while about household duties, and in the evening during the regular circles, but pursue them in the silent watches of the night, playing the pranks of the old-time poltergeists, and making it uncertain whether or no they will wake in bed or in the crotch of some tree on the summit of an adjacent mountain. The sketches which accompany this chapter represent with fidelity the appearance of the dining room, kitchen, and pantry, or buttery, over which extends the one large room where the nightly circles are held. They are intended to show that no trapdoors afford to confederates the opportunity of communication from below. The dining room communicates directly with a large apartment in the main part of the house, now used for a general sitting and reception room, but which, until the new hall was built, was the circle room. The kitchen and pantry are side by side, beyond the dining room, and separated from it by a laved and plastered partition, with doors joining from each into it. There is also a door which gives communication from the kitchen to the pantry through their dividing longitudinal partition. The ceilings of kitchen and pantry are laved and plastered. The kitchen is an odd, dingy little place with smoky walls and a worn floor, but it affords a retreat for the family when the house is crowded with visitors, and such of the latter as at such times are privileged to sit with the boys about the cooking stove, and smoke a pipe, and chat upon the day's topics, are regarded with much of the same envy as the favorite at court, who is passed by obsequious lackeys into the presence, while the rest cool their heels in the corridor. I have had my days of favor, like the courtier, and passed many a pleasant hour in this little kitchen, in an atmosphere so dense with pipe smoke that we could barely see each other across the room. I have sung my songs and told my comic stories, and heard Horatio sing his songs, and William Tell, in his own pathetic way, of the cruelties he suffered in boyhood, and I really fancied that by keeping on my good behavior, I might be allowed to do my work pleasantly and thoroughly. But however, I will not anticipate. If the reader will turn to the rear view of the Eddy homestead, he will observe in the gable of the L extension, just over the square window of William's cabinet, to other windows. These light a cockloft over the circle room. I confess that it never occurred to me to go up there and see what sort of place it might be, as after careful inspection of the room itself I was satisfied that no communication existed between the two, but one afternoon a lady visitor, subject to trance obsessions, and professing to be influenced by a spirit at the time, called my attention to the fact that, with all my shrewdness, I had overlooked this cockloft, though I could not imagine how spirit or mortal could detect the omission in the penciled notes in my pocket diary. I nevertheless went up a ladder in the adjoining vestibule, and, creeping through ancient cobwebs, from rafter to rafter, I saw that there was nothing worth coming to see. The mystery could not be solved there. Chapter 3, Personal Matters. I take it for granted that the conductors of two of the great New York dailies would not have successively engaged me to investigate and describe the phenomena at the Eddy homestead, if they had supposed me either of unsound mind, credulous, partial, dishonest, or incompetent, and I, therefore, beg the numerous company of correspondents who have addressed me upon the subject, to spare themselves the trouble, and me the annoyance, of their letters. Proffered advice stinks, saith an old Arabian proverb more notable for strength than refinement. I know what I am about, and mean to tell just what I saw and how I saw it. To the impertinent people, of many localities, whom I never laid eyes upon, who ask of me to have secret writings read, lucky lottery numbers disclosed, and to write theses upon spiritualism, to remove their skepticism, I have nothing to say except that their letters go into the nearest grate. I certainly do not care the value of a brass farthing what they believe or disbelieve. If I truthfully report the facts, each has the same chance as myself to make his theory to fit them. 53. Imagine an Indiana physician sending a dirty package, stitched by a sewing machine, and coolly asking me, a perfect stranger, to furnish him the ammunition to blow up either himself or the spiritualists, in the following terms, which I give verbatim. I have read all the subtle arguments of the spiritualistic professors, am pretty well posted in all their talk of conditions, and see, but I want a real material sign, a test that will be palpable and beyond dispute. I hereby enclose to you a test that will convince the Jews, if it can be unraveled. Here are several envelopes, each fastened by a different process, and all of different shape, that cannot be opened without my knowing it. In the center one are some words written in a peculiar manner. Now I would like to have this same envelope returned to me, as it is, and with it also a description of the written words just as they are written. This will convince me that there is an intelligence beyond earthly intelligence in existence, and I shall find no difficulty in ascribing this intelligence to disembodied spirits. If the kind spirit will tell the number of envelopes and describe each, tell from what kind of a slip the paper was cut upon which the words are written, it would of course make the matter more interesting. Why do I write you? I will tell you. You appear to be like myself, not yet convinced, yet interested enough to take some trouble to test the matter further. I am now engaged upon an article on the subject of spiritualism, in which I shall explain, or attempt to explain, the whole matter under three heads: first, jugglery; second, superstition; and third, insanity. I shall wait a reasonable time to bear from you before I continue it. As a solution of this test will spoil all my arguments, speculations, and sophisms. And a St. Louis person asking to be told what lottery ticket to buy, thus, believing, if the manifestations are genuine, that they have the power to foretell coming events, and seeing no reasons why I may not ask a question through you in this letter, I would especially beg to be informed of the number that will draw Tile Capital Prize in the Louisville Lottery, next November. Hoping to hear from you soon, I remain, sir, yours truly. Here is an Illinois damsel who seems to have more affection for the neighbor who visited the gypsy camp than for Lindley Murray, being very anxious to know something of the future. Thought I would write you and tell you what I wanted to know, and that if you charged me anything, to tell me so in your answer, and I would willingly pay you. Will you please tell me what year and clay in the month myself and my sister next oldest to me will be married? Also give us a description of our future husbands and what their occupation will be in life. And will you please tell me how long it will be before my mother will be married, she being a widow lady, also have a half-brother who is owing a debt in another state, would like to know if he will ever pay that debt up. Also there is a gentleman, near neighbor, visited camp of gypsies, would like to know if he had his fortune told while there. Also please describe the lady he will marry. One more example will suffice. This comes from Alabama. I would like to learn the history or genealogy for my family. All I know is that one of my progenitors was a Stuart, in some lord's family in Europe, and ran off and married the said lord's daughter. I don't know the name of my progenitor, the given name, or the name of the lord or his daughter. Please try to learn what each of their names were, when married and where, and where the lord resided. The names of his children and grandchildren down to my father, what my father's name was and when he died, in fact, all that can be gained in regard to the genealogy of my family. If you will do so, I will be under lasting obligations to you, although a stranger, if, upon a revision of my MSS, for this work, I preserve these communications for permanent reference, it is in the hope that I may be passed over by that great company of idle persons, who employ the time that hangs heavy upon their hands to persecute those of their fellow men who are temporarily thrust before the view of the public. I do not, for one moment, admit the right of those who have never fitted themselves for discussing profound subjects, to intrude their crude notions and inconsequential personalities upon the busy privacy of men engaged in the serious concerns of life. The Eds get such letters as these by the score, often as many as 40 or 50 by every mail, and I might make this volume more humorous, if not more interesting, by quoting examples, but I spare the reader. I have been greatly impressed by this evidence of the wide interest in the subject of spiritualism, as I have also of the publicity that any novel or exciting story gains by republication in the newspapers. I recollect that by R. Taylor told me once, that at the foot of the Himalayas, in a garrison library, he encountered some of his own works, and described the deep impression then made upon his mind of the responsibility devolving upon a person who writes for the press. I trust I shall bear the lesson in mind in all that is written for these pages. 56. Chapter 4, Moonlight Materializations. Rude and uninviting as is the Eddy House itself, its surrounding landscape is truly charming. Lying in a valley, it affords from every window the view of grassy slopes, backed by mountain peaks that catch the drifting clouds on days of storm, and on those of sunshine take on rich tints of purple and blue. Just back of the house stretches a bottom pasture land, whose sod is so bright a green that I have wished a score of times that one of the Harts, or Smilly, or McEntee, or some other of our landscapists could transfer it with its grazing herd and noble background to canvas. The woods are just beginning to clothe themselves in their royal autumn hues, and from mountain foot to summit, crimson and gold mix with the prevailing mass of green, like jewels embroidered on nature's robe of state. But there appears to be slight evidence that this scenery has exercised an ennobling effect upon the inhabitants. They are usually a prosaic set, and I have vainly watched for any responsive glow when I have called their attention to the natural beauties around us. The Eds themselves form rather an exception to the rule. True, they waste no enthusiasm upon their familiar hills and valley, but the tenderness of their hearts is shown in the gathering of pet pigeons, dogs, parrots, ducks, and chickens, about them, and their innate refinement, by the hours snatched from menial toil, to water and trim their plants and flowers. The neighboring graveyard is a neglected plot of weeds, but their family enclosure is bordered by maples, and the graves are tended by loving hands. The headstone over poor Mrs. Eddy is so characteristic of the altered view of the change called death that a belief in spiritualism begets, that I give a sketch of it. English visitors to this place would find abundant relaxation in long walks or mountain climbing, but we Americans avail ourselves little of the privilege. In the depths of the woods the black bear still prowls, foxes abound, sables, mink, raccoons, hedgehogs, and occasionally panthers. await the pursuit of the hunter, and speckled trout throng the cold mountain streams to a sufficient extent to afford sport to the votaries of the rod and fly. But the minds of the people who come from far and near to this Vermont homestead are so bent upon the pursuit of the marvelous, that all day Iona, they sit and talk of last night's circle and past wonderful personal experiences, until one fairly gets a surfeit of the subject. They are a motley crowd, in sooth, ladies and gentlemen, editors, lawyers, divines and ex-divines, inventors, architects, farmers, peddlers of magnetic salves and mysterious nostrums, long-haired men and short-haired women, the growing hands of Fowler, and the cackling cocks, their fitting mates, women with an idea, and plenty of men. And women without any to speak of, people of sense and people of nonsense, sickly dreamers who prate of interiors and conditions and spheres as intelligently as a learned pig or a chattering magpie, clairvoyants and healers, real and bogus, phrenologists, who read bumps without feeling them, under spirit direction, mediums for tipping, rapping, and every imaginable form of modern spiritual phenomena, apostles with one and two arms, people from the most distant and widely separated localities, nice, clever people whom one is glad to meet and sorry to part from, and people who shed a magnetism as disagreeable as dirty water or the perfume of the Fetis Americanus. They come and go, singly and otherwise, some after a day's stay, convinced that they have been cheated, but the vast majority astounded and perplexed beyond expression by what their eyes have seen and their ears heard. Through all, the family jog on in the even tenor of their unsystematic way, receiving newcomers with distrust and letting life slide after a happy-go-lucky fashion. Those who stay longest with them have the most confidence in their mediumship, for they discover that their external misanthropy and curtness are the outcome of years of sorrow and injustice, the result of poor education and bad training. More than any man I ever met, William Eddy lives an interior life, and to be in relation, or supposed relation, with the people of the silent land, seems as natural to him as it ever was to the ecstatics of the early centuries or the recluses of Brahma. Among the few favorite localities of the neighborhood are Honto's Cave and Santum's Grave, of both of which the artist has supplied illustrations from sketches taken on the spot. The term cave is a misnomer in this instance, for the rude apartment by which the sprightly squaw's memory will be perpetuated is, like the cave and Central Park, formed by the leaning of one great fragment of rock against another. It lies in dense shadow at the bottom of a ravine, so shrouded in foliage that the cheerful sunlight scarcely penetrates the spot even at high noon. A clear mountain brook running through it ceaselessly awakens its tiny echoes, and the surface of its rocky walls is scarred in so curious a manner as to convey the impression that the furrows are the half-effaced inscriptions of some prehistoric people. A path, scarcely practicable for a wider foot than that of the chamois of the mountain goat, runs along one of the steep banks, and the wood resounds with the bubble of the streamlet. The sketch of the cave was drawn by Mr. Capps from Nature, the figures only being supplied from a published account of a spiritual séance held there on the 24th of May 1874, and the descriptions of eyewitnesses. There were present on the occasion in question, among others, the following persons, who may be referred to in corroboration of my story: Mr. Andrew Beebe, Ludlow, Mass; Charles Wakefield, Boston; James Little, Lake George, N.Y.; Mrs. Carolyn Goss, Hudson, Wisconsin; Wisconsin, Horatio wrote it, and perhaps Hudson means Madison; Mary E. Jewett and Albert Frost, Rutland, V.T., and the Eddy family. The night was warm, and a full moon rode high in the heavens. The company assembled at an early hour, and seated themselves on benches, formed by laying boards on convenient boulders, in the arched mouth of the cave. Messrs. Saley and Frostbad constructed a rude framework of joists, to support a curtain of shawls; green branches were piled in the farther end, so as to form a backing, and boards, loosely laid across the little brook, made a platform upon which the medium might sit on a camp stool. In composing his sketch, the artist has been obliged to omit the curtain and most of the bough backing, so as to permit the lights to shine through, and show the arrangement of the platform and framing. The spectators at this weird gathering sat silent for a while, and the stillness of the forest was broken only by the noise of a brook, the chirp of insects, and the rustle of the leaves as they stirred in the warm wind of spring. Suddenly the curtain was pushed aside, and the form of an Indian, fully accoutred, came out, stepped into the stream, and, stooping, made the motion of drinking some water from his band. All eyes were riveted upon him, when someone suddenly exclaimed, "See! Up there on the rock!" And high overhead appeared the giant spirit form of Santam in bold relief against the moonlit sky. Presently an Indian squaw was seen upon the verge of the rocky ledge to the right, peering down upon the startled group. Thus, at one time, three ghostly visitors were in sight, and while the audience gazed, all three disappeared. Then successively appeared at the cave's mouth, Honto, who knelt and made as if drinking from the brook, and several other red squaws and chiefs, each dressed after his or her own fashion, with plumes and beads, and the other braveries these simple aborigines love so well, William Eddy, meanwhile, talking within the cave so as to be heard by all. 65. A spirit voice presently called out that they had been there long enough, and if they would go to the old Indian campground hard by, more wonders would be shown them. The spot indicated is a level plateau not far from the Eddy house, and bears the traces of former councils in a circle of ancient hearths, where, beneath the sod, are to be found the vestiges of fires long since extinguished. Great maples, beeches, and here and there an oak, stand about the camping ground, giant sentinels, beneath whose shade, within the memory of men now living, the relics of once powerful tribes were accustomed to gather from time to time to celebrate their feasts. At one side a flat boulder set on end, marks the spot where Santam, or, perhaps, in view of his frequent appearance before my eyes in his spiritual form, I should say his body, was buried. He might, if one familiar with the classics should suggest it, say to me upon some occasion when we should meet in presence of the right kind of the medium, what Socrates did to his friend Crito, when asked by the latter where and how they should bury him. "Bury me in any way you please, if you can catch me to bury. Say, rather, Crito, say if you love me, where shall you bury my body?" Santam's cumulus has almost disappeared under the wash of a thousand rains, and a large maple, whose trunk at 4 feet from the ground measures 4 feet 7 inches in girth, has sent its roots into the chieftain's dust, and, for aught I know, may have incorporated it in the cells and fibers of its own heart. Upon the sketch will be noticed a rude cross chiseled in the stone by one of the Eddy boys. But, to resume our story, our wonder seekers having reached the place indicated by the spirit voice, hastily improvised a cabinet by pinning some shawls around the trunks of 3 trees, and William entered it. After a brief interval, the phantom shape of Asa Sprague, a mediumistic speaker of some note among the spiritists, emerged, and in a natural voice, addressed her hearers upon the one absorbing topic for about 15 minutes, her form and the very play of her features being clearly revealed in the bright moonlight. She was followed by Mrs. Gosbrother, who walked some 20 feet from the cabinet, and next by an Indian, who ventured a like distance away from his medium, and then swung himself up on the branch of a tree and vanished. The evening's wonders closed with the appearance of the spirit of the late William White, editor of the Banner of Light, the principal organ to the new creed. Mr. White was dressed in black broadcloth, and had on a white shirt with studs in the bosom, whereas William wore his usual rough working suit, and brown check shirt without collar or cuffs. In his hand the spirit held a copy of the journal he once edited, which he opened, and showed the characteristic heading that the publication of 35 successive volumes has made familiar to thousands of persons. The next morning Messrs. Saley and Swift revisited the cave to search for footprints in the soft earth. At the places where any mortal climbing the rocks would, of necessity, have trodden. But there were none to be seen. The specters had materialized themselves on the spots where they had respectively been seen. Chapter 5, Portents and Marvels. If a competent person were to collect and arrange in picturesque form all the psychological experiences of the Eddy family, as related by them, The result will be a book of as romantic interest as the story of Zsok's life. But I hardly think that the mere gift of clairvoyance, to say nothing of absolute mediumship, can be esteemed a great personal blessing. I doubt if man's relations to his own world are not so exacting as to make it the reverse of beneficial, at least to himself, to be in constant and close sympathy with the other. The visions of the lucid are beatific, but do they not make him less satisfied to pursue his homely round of duty upon reawakening?